My name is Brett Lambert, and I'll be your host today for a very interesting panel and also discussion by General Cartwright. Thanks again to Rolls-Royce for sponsoring this these sessions. They've been very interesting. This is the second to last one, and I think everyone who's come to previous events knows that this will be as interesting, if not more, than the events we have. A couple of quick rules before we get started. I would ask everyone to turn off their cell phones, but I know nobody does that, so just turn them to vibrate. It would be helpful. We'll have a little bit of time for Q&A during that period. Please identify yourself, wait for the microphone, and then ask your question. And if you have a statement, make it a one-sentence statement before the question. And then we'll move directly to the panel after the general has departed. He has to go to the Hill. I'm sure he would prefer to stay here, but he has to go to the Hill. I won't do a long introduction of the general. You all have his bio, a short bio in front of you, and I think most people in the room know him. I did call a few of his current colleagues and former colleagues to see if I could get a sense of really what his responsibilities were these days. And best I can figure it, he's in charge of everything military inside the building and everything military outside the building and around the world. But that's just for the day-to-day operations and future operations. That's pretty much encapsulates it. So with that, we really appreciate your time today and look forward to hearing you talk.
We tried for lavalier, but it didn't work out. Can you hear back there? Am I getting it across? Okay. I appreciate this opportunity. This is a bit of a difficult presentation from the standpoint that what you would like are answers and what I'm supposed to give you is process. And we'll see how close we can come to each other's needs here, but there are certain restrictions here as we try to work our way through QDR and some of the force posture issues. I was asked to talk about force posture and force projection, which I will do, but I'll do it in the context of the Quadrennial Defense Review, and we're working our way through that right now as a department, as most of you know. A little bit different this year, which is the standard caveat for almost anything you want to talk about, but fundamentally, Quadrennial Defense Review, we go through each time we do a administration change or the four-year period, whichever one drives it. We also have, this time around, a nuclear posture review, which is not that unusual, but is very, very important as we start to understand, because we're about to enter into the negotiations for START, and there are several other treaties that are really starting to emerge that we have to understand how we're going to move forward. We really have now kind of come through the catharsis, and no kidding, are not in the Cold War anymore. The question is, so what's different? What's different about our force? What's different about our strategy? How are we going to approach the world? What does it look like? Being forced by the questions in QDR, being forced by the realities of the wars that we're in, being forced by having to negotiate now with the START reviews and whatnot, what were prior enemies that we say we have a different relationship with. So where's the material reality of that, and what's it going to look like? And probably for me, the most important question is, what does deterrence as we go into the 21st century look like? What's our relationship out there, and how is that reflected then in our priorities of basing and posture and availability, all activities that I'll try to talk to here a little bit as we move forward. Some of the realities that we're trying to deal with and that I think will be center to the discussions of the Quadrennial Defense Review, and I'll put this in military parlance, you can translate it, but we often plan generally against two types of standards, most likely and most dangerous. And normally we will bias our planning, and have for many years now, to most dangerous, and then letting everything else hopefully be a lesser included case. Okay, that was the two, MRC, MTW, you pick your alphabet. But that was the general approach. Two, because you don't want to be blackmailed as you enter into one. But the reality here is two very high-end activities on the conventional force side to ensure that we could handle those things that we called most dangerous, the highest regret factors, however you want to look at that, and then let everything else be a lesser included case. The realities of the world that we live in today, whether you're talking what what we used to refer to as the high end of conventional force, and we would think of armies against armies and maneuver warfare and all of those types of things, versus what would be at the other end of the spectrum, which we thought about as non-nation states, groups, individuals, those types of activities. The reality that we're dealing with, particularly when you start to think about the nexus between weapons of mass destruction and extremists, the lethality is about the same at both ends. You can talk about scale, but the lethality is starting to blur across that range of operations. So when we look at the operations that we are in, the operations that we are likely to be in for the next 5 to 10 years, and this idea that the lethality is not necessarily anymore associated strictly with nation states, what does your force planning construct start to look like? How do you size against that construct, and what availability do you want to have? Planning being, these are the things I want to be able to do. Sizing, these are the resources that I'm likely to have, and therefore there is going to be some risk because the first one does not necessarily directly correlate to the resources available in the second one. And then availability talks to what are those things that I'm going to put at the top of the list against which I will position my force globally to respond to, and under what construct, how fast, whatnot. We talked for many years about regional contingencies, two major ones, having some separation in days, which early on, several years back, tended to equate to the speed at which we could move shipping. I mean, that was the real driver in the separation between the two fights. So what does that look like in the world that we're actually moving towards, the world that we're likely to be in? It is clear that we have a conflict whose character is not the same as we used to plan for, mostly from the standpoint of the temporal. In other words, we're going to be in conflicts, or there is the likelihood of being in conflicts, that exist for 5 to 10 years, maybe longer. That's fundamentally different than the planning constructs that we were in the past. Okay, so that's a reality that forces us to change. And so how do we start to think about that? How does it reflect in your planning? Is that the most dangerous? Is it the most likely? And are we going to shift the balance off of the high end of conventional to deal with the most likely? Opinion? We're going to have to address that. We're going to have to adjust the balance. You've heard the secretary talk, my secretary, often about making sure that the institution understands and fights the war that we're in, not necessarily the war we'd like to be in, that we plan for. And historically, we rarely fight the wars that we plan for. Okay, we always tend to be surprised. The question is, have you put yourself in sufficient strategic agility to be able to handle whatever it is that comes up in front of you? And that's the piece that keeps me up at night and you know, that you're worrying about. So as we enter into the analytic activities, one of the pieces that I was asked to focus in on here with you all is basing, strategic posture, okay? Where are you? And that generally most closely correlates to availability of the force. In other words, what do you want to be ready to do and how quickly do you want to be ready to do it, matched up against the severity of the consequence of not being ready to do it? And historically, the analytic underpinning of this is kind of falls into about 5 or 6 bins. You want to be out and be able to respond to at least what you think are the most likely consequences out there and the most dangerous. So we have permanent basing. We call it permanent change of station basing, but where you take your family, where you go for some extended tour, a place that has a building and a flagpole in another country, okay? And that basing is one of the elements of the force and the capability that we project out to be able to respond to whatever might happen out there, okay? And those forces associated with that activity, whether it's a BCT or an air wing or whatever it is, are generally accepted to be ready easily within the first 3 or 4 days of a conflict. And that's assuming that we had no warning and it just started. Okay, they can be ready to go probably the quickest of anybody. Okay? The second force posturing activity tends to be associated with those forces that are rotational. They may be rotational to a specific base. They may be rotational to a theater. Naval air tends to be a little more flexible and broader ranging. But they are brought forward, and their attribute is, one, they are generally more trained and more ready, okay? Just because they go through an extensive training and they go out and they stay there for some period of time, 3 months to a year, okay? They also are unencumbered. They didn't bring the families, okay? They can go wherever you tell them to go within the region or beyond. The downside tends to be that it takes three to make one. Okay, when you PCS a unit over, it's there. It doesn't have to rotate, so there's nobody back in the States training to replace it. So you kind of get a threefer out of a PCS organization. Okay, but they tend to come with encumbrances. They come with families, which don't tell any of the families I call them encumbrances. But they come with families. They come with caveats associated with the basing construct. You may not be able to leave that country. You may not be able to leave that country for a certain mission. All of these caveats tend to apply to these types of forces. That's the double edge on permanent basing. For the rotational forces, they tend to be wider ranging, more flexible, probably higher on the training scale because they had access to ranges that probably are not available in the overseas locations. The cost associated with PCS is the infrastructure cost, which, I mean, it should be no surprise to anybody, is extremely difficult to get funded. We don't like to build infrastructure in other people's nations. I mean, when it competes with infrastructure in the States, we don't have that many senators and congressmen that are representing those other countries. It's harder to get the money associated with overseas basing. It just really is. Hence, you know, I quip about this every once in a while, but really our bases are where we fought the Indians, the Japanese, or the Germans. I mean, that's where we are. And then we adapt, okay? And the real question is, can we change from that? Are we really disadvantaged by that? If so, how compelling is that argument as to get resourcing to be based someplace different? Okay, I mean, at the end of the day. So permanent basing, rotational basing. The third one is the prepositioned forces. Okay, this is where we put the equipment forward, but disconnect it from the force, and then roll the force in on top of it if we need it. The good part about this is that you can have a heavier force and respond more quickly because you don't have to move that entire force forward. You're moving the people and a few of the enablers, but you're not trying to move the entire force. That's the good side. The downside is you may not have trained on the same equipment you fall in on. The equipment you fall in on may not have all of the upgrades of what you got in the home training equipment. It tends to be in a physical location, so hopefully that location is the right location for the conflict. It certainly is the right location for the conflict you anticipate. It may not be the right location for the conflict you actually find yourself in, and therefore the timeline gets extended. Okay. And the other piece is you're buying two sets of equipment for every soldier. Okay. I mean, that's just a fact. Now, that leverage is important enough that we do it in certain cases, but we do it with an understanding that the cost is pretty significant. The other side of the prepositioning discussion and the character of the prepositioning force is that you get the equipment that's there. It is generally positioned for a mission. We would call it combat loaded. In other words, I roll in and I jump into the tanks and the ammunition is there and you're ready to go. But if you didn't need the tanks first, what you need are the light mobility, that may not be out of the cave, out of the building, out of the ship first. And you've got to wait for that. We're starting to adjust that to do more of what we would call an administrative load so that you can tailor this activity, particularly with our mobile prepositioning stocks. So if what you're dealing with is an earthquake and what you need is the water and the hospital and all of those types of things, you can actually get to that stock without having to unbury it, so to speak. Okay, but we're toying with what's the right balance between an administrative mission loading versus a combat loading. Okay, and how much of which should we have and where? And what's the right balance between a fixed location and a mobile capability for pre-positioned stocks? Okay. The next one in categories is probably, it has been one we have been working on. I would tell you that it's in much better shape today than it was 5 years ago, not because of any avoidance, but because the capabilities and the technologies are starting to emerge. But it is called global strike. Okay. And global strike is the acknowledgement that there are certain forces that really do have global regard, so to speak. They can move to global scale very quickly. Okay. Now, historically, we have thought in terms of conventional bombers. The reality today is conventional bombers for global strike, probably not credible. They're too slow. They're too slow. They're too intrusive. They require too many mother may eyes to get from point A to point B. Airspace cooperation, weapons passing through other countries, all of these types of things tend to limit this activity. What we're trying to understand is what are the characteristics and attributes of global strike? Can we, in fact, generate those capabilities and deliver them in a credible way? So in global strike, the two things that I would put there, and I've said this many times in public and got the scar tissue to prove it, but the reality here is the low end of global strike is probably any place on the face of the earth in an hour. Okay. The high end of global strike is any place on the face of the earth in about 300 milliseconds, and that's cyber. And the other one is some sort of conventional long-range, hypersonic, whether it's exo-atmosphere or endo-atmosphere type of capability, which would drive you in scale to only those targets that you really feel you need to address because that's expensive. Okay, so there is a scale issue associated with global strike, and you cannot be frivolous with that. You can argue about, and plenty of people do, about the ambiguity. I mean, we'll go through all of those issues. But at the end of the day, we need something to reach out. And why do we need something to reach out for that capability? Why is that now becoming compelling? Because of the proliferation of ballistic missiles, short, medium, and long-range ballistic missiles. If what we're trying to deal with is a conflict that could be over in minutes, then you have to have something that deters that conflict, and it probably needs to be more than nuclear. In other words, you've got to have a broader range of choices beyond just a nuclear response to something like that. Okay? And that conflict, because of the proliferation of ballistic missiles, is becoming more and more credible. Okay? So what is it that we have? And I'm going to step back now to the PCS. PCS generally should be ready, able to engage in about 3 days. This is the availability side of the construct. Rotational forces, probably somewhere in the 1 to 2 days, if they are positioned correctly, if they are as far out of position as they can be. Let's take an aircraft carrier. It's at one end of the Pacific AOR and the conflict's at the other. We're still dealing in probably 4 or 5 days. Okay. Prepo, think more in the terms of 2 weeks. And so when you move out of that into global strike, what gets the unprepared, the bolt out of the blue, the ballistic missile to somebody, to your neighbor or farther away? What's the timeline associated with doing that? Nothing in those first ones gets at the problem of minutes. And that's why we're trying to understand what we need to have in availability and how much of your resource and what's the regret factor of not addressing these types of threats. And inside now of global strike, we also put missile defense. So it should not be, you should never think of these constructs in an offense or defense only approach, because that leaves you vulnerable to somebody trying to beat or defeat your single approach. Okay? So missile defense for me is part of global strike. It has to be. Okay. You don't want the only approach here to be, I'm going to hurt you. They ought to believe it, but you don't want that to be your only approach, nor do you want your only approach to be a defensive only, because that's generally what's called the Maginot Line. It only works to a certain extent, and then it loses its credibility because there is no penalty for the attack. And this is just kind of art of war stuff, but it is what we think about as we try to work ourselves through this. There's one other character or quality here that I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes on. It is a construct that, quite frankly, came out of the Cold War, but has, in my mind, credibility today, and that is extended deterrence. In other words, what is it you're willing to do for your ally through some agreement to protect their interests and therefore shape their force in a way that you think might be more stabilizing to the region? In the Cold War, we thought about this as nuclear weapons. Should you have nuclear weapons, or will I promise you that I'll come to your aid and take care of you, and therefore you don't need these weapons? Okay. What should that look like as we go to the 21st century? Is it credible that it is only nuclear? I don't believe that it is. So what parts or what elements of global strike also significantly contribute to extended deterrence? What capabilities would we like to have to assure our allies that we would be there and that when we come, it will be credible, it will be on time, it will be compelling to the adversary, and therefore they don't need to go in that direction? Is it more of a burden-sharing activity, or is it a technical capability and quality that someone else either can't afford or can't generate? What does extended deterrence start to look like as we go to the 21st century? If a country in the world that we're going to, and let's go back to the nexus of extremism and nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, or in cyber, the world that we're moving towards, attribution is not what it used to be. Okay? Everything doesn't come with a home address. So how do we start to put in place those kinds of capabilities that give our allies comfort, don't start an unnecessary arms race, can address issues of challenged attribution? Okay, in other words, we don't know for sure right away who did this. How do we start to build that? That is part of the debate that we're trying to push into the Quadrennial Defense Review that will, in fact, have an impact on our availability constructs and our basing constructs. The last one, and then I'll let you pick on me. There are basing activities that go on that have very little to do where we physically are that are absolutely critical to our ability to be global. We're seeing this in Afghanistan right now with what people are referring to as the northern distribution routes. But a series of agreements and basing constructs, whether they be forward operating locations, cooperative security locations, that allow us in particular to logistically sustain a fight and to move to that fight and back. We don't necessarily have to have a flagpole there. We don't necessarily have to live there day in and day out. But without the access, you know, it's that logistics, logistics, logistics. You've got to have some capability to move this stuff globally wherever you end up. Now, the good part about global strike is it takes very little of that. The bad part about global strike is the scale is not enough to sustain a fight. You've got to be able to move to the sound of guns. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to be able to do that. And putting that infrastructure together globally and the caveats and whatnot that you have to negotiate your way through about how you can and for what you can use these sites are critical to our ability to move around the globe and sustain what appears to us at least to be extended or persistent engagement, whether that be a shooting war or something close to it. How do you get to that construct? Okay, so those attributes to me are what we are analytically going through to understand what we need to do and how we need to be positioned globally. Whether where the Indians and the Japanese and the Germans were is okay, or whether we need to adjust from that to handle things like Central Africa, to handle areas that we know we're going to have to be able to move to as we look to the future. How do we manage that, and what is the right laydown to project force for this nation globally? Thank you.
Thank you very much, General. And while everyone's getting their questions together, I might ask the first one. I mean, you laid out very nicely the four basing options. We had General Casey here the other day that talked about the ability to respond to a Korean incident in probably 90 days, and that it would not be his responsibility necessarily. So I'm wondering, in your planning, as you go through these four options, I'm assuming they're not mutually exclusive, that you may have a PCS that's reinforced by a global strike. And I'm just wondering about the process to understand how you work those scenarios.
I mean, essentially, we look at those areas where we think we're most likely to be engaged, and that's always a recipe for not being right. But we look at those areas. We look at the realities of the terrain, the weather, the political environment, et cetera. And then we strike a balance that's tailored for the problem we're trying to solve and the area that we're trying to work. So it may be heavy, like it is in Europe, on permanent stationing and light on rotational forces. It may be more challenged in the demographics or the political willingness to have us based there and be much more heavily based on rotational forces and global strike. What we try to understand and then strike the balance. Once you put the balance together, what is it you're there for? What is the scenario that you really believe you're there for that is broad enough to carry to cover the reasonable breadth of contingencies? And then try to figure out what it is. This is the trade between, gee, do I need a bomber or do I need an aircraft carrier? Do I need a division or do I need a MEU? What are the right elements of the force that have a legitimate chance of at least stabilizing the situation for some period of time, 5, 10, 15 days, until other forces more appropriate can close? And so that's the calculus. So there is an awful lot in this that is more art than science, but at the end of the day, you have to be convinced, as does your enemy, that the combination of what you put out there will not tolerate any mischief.
Excellent. Let's go over here. If you could wait for a microphone and identify yourself, please.
I know who he is.
Oh, sorry. You were supposed to give me a list of people. I
wasn't. He probably knows where I live, too. General, thanks for your comments and the CIS for hosting this. My question's about cyber, hoping you can expand a bit, because that is a domain where the military will be forward deployed even more in coming years. To use your word, what are the encumbrances on military moving so robustly into cyber? A couple come to mind. Privacy debate as cyber becomes militarized. And do you anticipate a debate like when NORTHCOM was stood up, where people say, what's the military's role in cyber here at home versus the away game that's more acceptable?
Sure.
Thank you.
That would obviously be an entire presentation, but cyber, from our standpoint, both in the construct of defensive, so protecting either our capabilities, our IT capabilities, our weapons capabilities, and defending the nation, and from the construct of understanding what's going on out there in the world. And one of the attributes of cyber is that, unlike most intelligence fora, you can actually start to understand intent in cyber because you start to see what people are saying and understand where they're going. And then the offensive side of it, okay? There will be a cyber capability at the tactical level, and so we will deploy. We do deploy it forward, whether it is in a PCS configuration or a rotational configuration. There is an operational level which tends to be based regionally, and there is a strategic capability. Okay, and we will, over the next few days, start to roll out the organizational constructs associated with that. But we have demonstrated over the last 5 years, both at the tactical, operational, and strategic levels, the viability and the utility of cyber capabilities. Okay, the challenges, you named a few of them. I'll just go beyond the ones that you've named. What's proportionality look like in cyber? What does attribution look like in cyber? how do you understand sovereignty in the cyber domain? It doesn't tend to pay a lot of attention to geographic boundaries. So many of the questions have to do with the area of regard of any kind of use of cyber. In other words, can you control it to a geographic area? Is the target that you're going after in the same country as the area of hostilities, a kind of turn of an art of law and military activities? There is an area of hostility in which you have certain rules of engagement. If you go outside that geographic area of hostility, are you still applying the same rules, or do you switch over to what we would call Article 3, the standard rules and laws that we would be failed to in the United States? Okay, so courts and grand juries and things like that. How do you start to understand that? Those are challenges that we are pushing on. What does attribution look like, not only for the adversary, but for us? You know, when you enter into cyber, do we put, you know, the tail flash on every one of the dots and digits that says, you know, United States Air Force has passed through here? Probably not. So what does the definitions between covert and clandestine look like in law? Very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to understand this. When you have a checks and balances between, let's just pick the Department of Defense and the Department of State, if I pass through your country, do I have to talk to the ambassador? Yeah, I mean, this is not, I mean, if I had the answer and we all agreed, this would be easy, but that it is very difficult. So back to global strike. If this is part of global strike, how many yeses and nos do we have to go through, and how quickly can you get through them in order to use some of these tools? So those are the challenges that are out there, but they're more about how we regulate the activity than how the art of war would be applied. And I probably am not saying that exactly right, but what we're trying to understand is, in that regulatory construct, whatever emerges, then how can you take the art of war in combination with other domains, other weapons, other platforms, apply those together in a way that is coherent and actually makes sense and appears and can be judged by anybody as being appropriately proportional in the activity and responsible? And those are the questions that are now really starting to emerge vis-a-vis cyber.
Okay. Go back. Let's go way back here, and then I'll come back around up here. There, microphone. And I promise to get to a former ambassador. Let's see.
Richard Weitz, the Hudson Institute. You laid out the reasons why you consider prompt global strike to be very important. The Russian position in the post-START talks now is that they prefer if you don't have these conventional armed delivery vehicles, but if you do, they want them to count at least equivalent to what they attributed to them in a certain number of nuclear warheads. Do you like prompt conventional global strike sufficiently to be willing to make that trade-off in terms of nuclear strike?
Let me take that question and turn it a different way. The strategy, the stated goal of the country, is to reduce nuclear weapons to the maximum extent practical with a goal of zero. So judging every weapon and transaction as an en route movement towards zero. What is the incentive in the START construct to reduce? You reduce to get the signature on the paper, and then after that you reduce no more. You stay stagnant for 10 years or whatever the life of the treaty is. I would rather have in the treaty construct an incentive structure that allows you to continue to reduce as appropriate for your national security interests. I have no problem with a conventional warhead counting as a nuclear, because I'd like to get the nuclear ones out and the conventional ones in where appropriate. So to me, what we have to understand in our negotiations and start with the Russians are, what's the incentive structure to continue down? If there isn't any, we won't. Trust me, we haven't. So I have no problem with that counting rule, okay? Because I'm relatively convinced that if we do an in lieu of weapon for a nuclear weapon, that it will get to the end state and be usable in a way that gets to the end state we desire in national security. So I have no problem with counting them. But I do believe we have to have some incentive structure to find ways other than weapons of mass destruction to get to our ends.
Back here, yes.
I met you at saw you at a ceremony a few weeks ago for John Young, outgoing at AT&L. Anyway, I worked with him as an executive coach since 2003, mostly on big programs that took decades to develop. About 6 months ago, I discovered this organization talking about smart power, which led me to counterinsurgency warfare. And how do you win the wars we're fighting today? It's not necessarily with all of those big programs. So I'm wondering what degree of emphasis you will discuss this in the QDR. And I'm also wondering to what extent are the combatant commanders connected to the acquisition process? Let me just add one other point. In the Secretary's April 6th speech, he was very hard on America's defense establishment, saying there was no room for the warfighter in that establishment up until this point. I just wondered whatever thoughts or reflections you have on that.
I think, and I'll try to pick this apart a little bit so that I can get it in bites, but the first piece here is the long acquisition cycles to get to capability. Okay. We're at a crossroads in the country in that we're trying to figure out how you take an industrial society, bring the IT or information age into it, acknowledge the fact that we're still going to do industrial things, but that the IT is where the leverage is. It's where competitive advantage is. And it doesn't matter whether you're dealing in business or whether you're dealing in warfighting. The competitive advantage is on the IT side of the equation. So we have a culture that says, I've got a problem, give me an industrial solution. The problem with that approach is that the adversary is turning well inside of your ability to produce new capability. Okay? So as we look at platforms, we have to look at them. Using the right words here. If you build an airplane, you build it for a threat. Okay? It has a radar that finds a target on the ground and drops a bomb on it, or a target in the air and launches a missile at it and guides it. All the rest of the information is tossed overboard. It's only there for a threat. Okay? We use the person to adapt. At best, we can upgrade that airplane once every 4 or 5 years, and that's about the best you get out of it. So its utility is limited in an IT world. Okay? And I can turn inside of your ability to change. So if I'm the IED fight in Baghdad, I can put a switch into my platform every 30 days, and you've got to turn inside of that to defeat me. Okay? So the question here is, what can we do to change that? Well, we talk more about capabilities based, the shift to capability. I don't know what the fight's going to look like tomorrow. I for sure don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years. What about that platform is compelling for us to build it? And then what about that platform is going to make it relevant 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years out? And it's not going to be the hardware, and it's not going to be the sensor. It's going to be the ability to gather the information and use it to solve the problems that you really have, not the problems that somebody told you you ought to have. Okay? Making that cultural shift is very difficult. But what we need and what we get off of today, for instance, and I'll just stick with there, off of unmanned systems is because we are not on board with a pilot, we take all of the information and bring it back. And then it is essentially agnostic to what you use it for. I may use it for surveillance. I may use it for targeting. I may use it for any number of things. So how do we start to move to a world in which the reality here today is that storage and processing are free, as long as you have access to upgrade and do that. So we're moving storage and processing out to the edge because that's where the transactions are going on. That's where the advantage is. That's where competitive advantage is. It's not back in the headquarters. Okay? And we're putting programmers out there with it to solve the problems the warfighter really has, not the ones somebody in Washington wanted them to have. That's the Secretary's frustration. How long does it take to make the cultural shift? Whether it's organizational or whether it's mindsets, how long does it take to make that shift?
Over here. Oh, sorry. Yep.
Morning, General. Colin Clark with DoD Buzz. Congress has made pretty clear that they are extremely uncomfortable with the targeting issues on global strike. You've been touting this for, I think, 5 years or so.
I see the scar tissue.
So given that fundamental problem, how do you address it? And I won't even ask the where's the technology question.
Yeah, I think you should start with where's the technology. I mean, that was their big challenge, is ambiguity, and then how you reach out. Not, there's never been a question about the military necessity side of the equation. It's really been in a little bit of the ambiguity issue, because if you're going to move that far that fast, how can you do it in a way that I know what's on there and I don't elicit a response that's inappropriate for the action, okay? So we're working our way through that activity. But if I go back and I'm willing to accept counting rules that say, no matter what I launch at you, you're going to have to assume it's nuclear. I just may put a conventional warhead in it because I know I can solve the problem with a conventional warhead, and I don't need to spend the money to keep a nuclear one on there, nor do I need to have the effect that a nuclear will deliver. That, to me, pretty straightforward. The second piece of this is there a technology that's coming down the road that would eliminate the ambiguity? Today we deal for our long-range global strike missile-type activities in what are called minimum energy trajectories. It's the arc. You know, I go up, I leave the atmosphere, and I come down. The reality is we don't necessarily need to do it that way. We can do a very different profile, one that either stays in the atmosphere the whole way, has a very different characteristic. If that's what it takes to discriminate or basing constructs, then those are all possible. The question is the target set sufficiently compelling for the investment to come to those technical solutions for the challenges that not only the Congress, but a lot of people saw in conventional weapons, okay? That's the issue. And then what kind of treaty verification, validation construct are you willing to enter into? To me, I think there's a window of opportunity here, number one. And number two, I think the target set is becoming more and more compelling. There are just too many things out there that are inappropriate for a nuclear response. And so the credibility of a nuclear response is being undermined.
General, thanks for being here today. I'm a former ambassador, Bill Courtney.
I said I'd get an ambassador.
We, in the State Department, we encourage ambassadors to read Failsafe. It helps clarify what role the U.S. ambassador, in this case in Moscow, will have in permissions for global strike.
Sure.
The issue of cooperative security locations, facilities that in countries where it might be too sensitive to have bases, was something that was discussed a lot in the UCOM AOR a few years ago. For example, some of the non-Russian republics in the former Soviet Union might qualify for those, but you wouldn't want to put bases there. What do you think of the future of the construct of a cooperative security location?
I mean, they have emerged as a very credible way for us to, particularly to move goods and services globally. There are numerous nations that are comfortable with a business agreement and arrangement, and some of them say, I'm good with this, and you can do it as long as you use my services or as long as you don't do anything lethal. Or the caveats are there, but they allow us to move goods and services globally. To preset them so that you can count on them is probably a subset of the opportunities that are out there globally. In other words, people are more willing to enter into these agreements when they understand precisely what it is you want to do versus, gee, I'd just like to make sure that I always have access to this airbase and I don't know why, and I'll pass through there regularly. That is a little more difficult. It tends to be easy with our friends and more difficult with those who are straddling the fence as to they don't know whether this week they're our friend or our enemy. But they have become, in particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, a great tool. And we're trying to work the concept now associated with the conflict in Afghanistan in particular, where we want to make sure that we have more than one way to close on the fight so that we, as a nation, can't be coerced into an outcome because of our ability to resupply or conduct logistics actions. I think they're a great tool. And for the most part, they really do give the embassy a great activity because they can bring it into their economic side, they can bring it into their business side, they can create interrelationships that otherwise may not have been there or might be foreclosed if it required a physical presence, a base or something in their on their territory.
Okay, one last question over here.
Oh, ringer.
Doug Fife, Hudson Institute. Nice to see you, General. Could you comment on reconstruction and stabilization operations and the issue of what kind of progress has been made with the Office of Stabilization and Reconstruction at the State Department, the idea of the Civilian Response Corps? Is the military working on the integration with the State Department as the kind of agent for civilian agencies for stabilization and reconstruction?
Yeah. The stabilization and reconstruction activity tends to have that attribute that I talked about early on of extended relationship. I mean, you measure it in years rather than weeks and months. The difficult part about it is it requires, to get it going, it requires an upfront investment that generally requires manpower, presence, a surge that probably takes any organization a couple of years to then make it routinized and into the bureaucracy. That's where, in this case, state has the greatest challenge is creating capacity from a cold start, and where the department tends to have the greatest resilience because we have capacity by necessity that's available generally to do these types of things. I don't think that there's much disconnect between State Department and DOD on this issue. We've seen two secretaries of state and our Secretary of Defense testify to this together on more than one occasion. The challenge is in the character of the State Department's ability to have that residual force to be able to then apply it and then sustain it for multiple years, and the compelling arguments, discussions, debates that we would like to have that would justify the resource allocation and the committee structure that would be able to administer it, the oversight side of this on the congressional side. Those are some administrative barriers that have been difficult, quite frankly, thus far, to get resolved. It's not a case of people not believing that this is an important thing and that there are ways to get at it. It's a question of there's probably more than one way to do this, how much of this force do we want to have, and then is the State Department configured in such a way to manage these type of activities and respond to them quickly? And if not, then what are the hybrids that might come from that, and what's appropriate, and when do you make a transition from something that ought to be a classic state activity that DOD enters into for some period of time until state can? I mean, that's a hybrid out of it, and how do you have that discussion? That's where I think the debate is.
Well, thank you very much, General. I appreciate it. Appreciate your time, and wish you luck on the Hill. While the General leaves, we're going to crack on with our panel. So if they could come up here. All right. We'll get started here. If you could take your seats as soon as possible so we can get the panel going, get as many questions in as possible. I'll get started by a quick introduction of the moderator for today. We're very pleased to have Robert Burns, who's going to moderate the panel and introduce the panelists. As most of you know who follow this industry, he's a distinguished journalist with many years, I won't say how many, in foreign policy and defense. He's been on the East Coast all of his career. I say that because he started out in Missouri, and I'm from western Kansas, so that was always the East Coast. But he was overseas, covered NATO and has now become the European Union. Continued to progress through AP until 99 when he became the National Security Correspondent, a position he held until 2008. So he was there for some interesting times, and I can't remember how many trips you made to Iraq, but it was more than most people in this room, I think. So 22, that seems like a lot. He now covers the State Department. Again, we're very pleased to have him moderate this our distinguished panel, and I'll let him make some brief introductions. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Brett, and happy to be here, and I will introduce each of the panelists, and they will each make a few remarks, and then they will field your questions. On my far left is Dan Els. He's a senior analyst in defense matters at the Congressional Research Service. His particular area of expertise is in military installations, military construction appropriations, defense logistics, weapon development, and the defense industrial base. He also served 20 years in the Navy. Next is Alex Cooley. He's associate professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia. His research examines the politics of state sovereignty and international negotiations over sovereignty, including U.S. and Russian overseas military basing agreements. Professor Cooley has conducted research on base-related issues in 14 different overseas hosts and has lectured on the topic at leading universities and policy institutes worldwide. And to my immediate left is Ambassador Robert Loftus. He's Senior Advisor for International Affairs at the Industrial College of the Armed Services at NDU, where he also teaches strategic leadership. From 2004 to 2007, he was the Senior Advisor for Security Negotiations and Agreements in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs at the Department of State. He also has served abroad, including in Mozambique and other overseas posts. And with that, I'll ask each of them to make a few remarks, and then they will be ready to take your questions. And I guess we should begin with Dan Els.
Thank you very much. Let me start off with the standard disclaimer. I'm appearing here as myself in the guise of a subject matter expert. I am not representing the Congressional Research Service, nor am I representing Congress, per se. So anything I say, you can blame me, but don't blame my organizations, please. Let me begin by noting that the appearance of General Cartwright and the makeup of the panel you see here illustrate the existence of a governmental partnership between the Department of State and the Department of Defense in matters of overseas basing of our military forces. And the fact that I'm here underscores a fundamentally different partnership that also impacts overseas basing issues, a constitutional partnership between the President and the Congress. Commentators have often cited the ability of Congress to regulate activity in the executive branch by exercising the power of the purse. But we might also recall the Constitution purposely binds the Congress and the President together in other ways. Article 1 grants to Congress the power to regulate foreign commerce, declare war, raise and support armies, provide and maintain a navy, regulate military forces, and provide for the arming, organization, and discipline of the militia, what we now call the National Guard. Article 2 appoints the President as the Commander-in-Chief and also empowers him to appoint ambassadors and consuls to make treaties, but only with the adult supervision of the Senate. Both houses of Congress have long been concerned with the executive management of our overseas bases. In 2003, the Senate Committee on Appropriations wrote in its Military Construction Appropriations Report that for several years, the committee has expressed concern that our overseas basing structure has not been updated to reflect the realities of the post-Cold War world. Our nation is dealing with new threats, new strategies, new force structure, new deployment concepts, and new geopolitical realities, yet a basing structure born of and rationalized for the Cold War endures. Congress went on to create an overseas basing commission, not to preclude in any way the Defense Department's ongoing efforts to develop a comprehensive and integrated global defense presence and basing strategy. Rather, it would provide Congress an independent view of the nation's overseas basing requirements and aid it in its oversight role. The commission delivered its report in May of 2005, saying in part that the commission believes that change is necessary, but guided change that considers the entirety of the security components of the United States, not just those related to the Department of Defense. The commission found that the overseas basing structure cannot be viewed in isolation from a myriad of other security-related considerations. We have concluded that we are doing too much, too fast, and a reordering of the steps is necessary. We call, therefore, for a process of deliberation and review to accompany the zeal and aggressiveness to act. Fast forward now to last year and a report prepared by the House Committee on Appropriations during the markup of its military construction appropriation bill. On September 17, 2004, the Department of Defense delivered its report to Congress on strengthening U.S. global defense posture. This shift toward forward operating sites and cooperative security locations reduced the need for new overseas military construction projects and increased reliance on host nation and contractor-maintained facilities. The committee is concerned that the department has not made a concomitant effort to ensure that planning, budgeting, and financial management practices are in place to ensure adequate oversight of the costs and operations of this new structure. The committee is also concerned by recent developments that have called into question the underlying rationale for the integrated global presence and basing strategy that was developed from the Global Posture Review. The committee noted recent revisions in plans for troop basings in European Command, in Korea, and the creation of Africa Command, ending its remarks by stating that, finally, the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have demonstrated a need to reconcile this new basing approach to long-term conflicts involving continuous rotation of large forces to the same areas over a period of many years, blurring the distinction between forward-deployed and forward-stationed forces and between expeditionary and enduring locations. If nothing else, this illustrates the remarkable patience and enduring hopefulness of the Congress in the ability of the executive branch to figure out a rationale for stationing troops overseas. In more recent hearings, both defense officials and members of Congress have expressed the hope that the 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review will provide that rationale. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you to the conference organizers for convening this meeting and inviting me. I very much represent myself, and I suppose I represent the Ivory Tower, perhaps even worse, the Ivory Tower in New York. These comments are really directed in terms of analyzing what I think are some of the political complexities with overseas basing arrangements and pointing to some of, I think, the future trends that we might see in some of the trade-offs that perhaps policymakers might want to consider. Really, I sort of have three baskets here. First is we need to sort of get, I think, a better handle on some of the political complexities with creating all of these different categories of overseas installations. I think it's fairly non-controversial now to say that in many, if not most, cases of these forward deployments, host countries want very different things, or perhaps not very different, but certainly different things from the relationship than we do. Yes, there might be sort of common threats that can be tackled together, but some host countries want political support, some want legitimacy, some want just money. So I think that needs, you know, we need to bear that in mind and sort of, I think, plan appropriately for that. I think a very good example of this are the Central Asian cases, both Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, where it became clear over the course of events after these were established in the fall of 2001 that both the government of Uzbekistan and the government of Kyrgyzstan saw different benefits from the relationship than we did. Other thing to think about on the political front, how do we cope with regime change in these places where we have either cooperative security locations, forward operating sites, and we see an increasing tendency of changes in regimes or new regimes to question or invalidate previous agreements on procedural grounds, either that they were negotiated and not ratified or that circumstances have changed or sort of whatever. So I think anticipating political change, being ready for it, coping with it, having more of a pivoting strategy towards alternative political actors, all this should be part of planning. Second basket, I would identify economics. Officially, we do not pay rent for facilities, but one of the trends I've noticed over the last few years is we see increasing demands for quid pro quo, ranging from Kyrgyz demands for more money for Manas and compensation to even the Polish government demanding greater benefits or upgrading of their air defenses in terms of missile defense deployment. So this is a trend that sort of mirrors something that happened in the 70s and the 80s in the Cold War, but we haven't seen in a while. And you know, my sense is this is going to keep ratcheting up. Third basket is I think we need to think a little bit more about media and PR strategy about what these facilities do, right, and have, I think, a more robust media outreach in some of these countries. It's certainly true that some of these smaller facilities, we have certain political issues, we don't want to draw attention to their presence and so forth. On the other hand, this is what allows domestic rumor mills to start going out of control. And Manas, again, is a really good example of this. For too long, we took the perspective that we don't really talk about the base, we don't publish an FAQ on the website. And the fact of the matter is, young Kyrgyz teenagers don't know what the IMU was. They don't know what happened in 2001 firsthand. And so sort of more, you know, the propaganda surrounding Manas has really gotten out of control and was not countered, I think, sort of sufficiently. Finally, let me flag, I think, two central challenges and going forward. One is the global environment. It's become almost trite to say globalization changes everything. But I think in terms of basing and access agreements, it makes it more and more difficult to segment relations with your various partners. So you see convergence on a couple of things. Host countries examine the deals everyone else is getting, both in terms of money and in terms of SOFA issues. That they now consult to see if they're getting the golden standard or if they can learn from other base hosts and so forth. On the other side of things, we're seeing the rise of more globalized anti-base, anti-U.S. base type of movements. Some are NGOs that have now globally networked with each other. They exchange tactics, slogans, and so forth. And you saw a couple of examples of this that actually had some political impact and even operational consequences. One was the protest against the Vicenza relocation in Italy. This is very unusual for Italy, which traditionally has had a very supportive political environment. That particular group tapped into the anti-globalization movement of Genoa that was there before, sort of ready-made infrastructure, and arguably together with the Afghan issue, this brought down, albeit temporarily, the Prodi government. Two, you saw this play out in Ecuador, where anti-base movements there associated with our presence in Manta tapped into the global anti-base network, convinced policymakers and parliamentarians in Ecuador that extending the lease would be a bad idea. So I think we need to sort of bear that in mind, that we can't just assume that we can keep these agreements sort of compartmentalized and segmented the way we did before. Final point I want to make is, I wonder if there might be a trade-off between the kind of flexibility that the general talked about, the lightness of footprint that we want, and then our capacity to be able to deliver adequate quid pro quo in some of these agreements. A lot of these installations and these CSLs are meant to be temporary or expandable or so forth, and yet we see demands of host countries wanting increasingly more stuff. And one of the things that opens these installations and these hosts out to are sort of alternative offers, right? And we saw this, again, in the Manas case, right? Russia comes in, promises $2 billion worth of aid and investment. That situation is still resolving itself. But definitely the opportunity for a counteroffer was particularly instructive. And the same thing in the Manta case in Ecuador, where a Chinese-based firm came in with a much greater offer of redoing the infrastructure there than U.S. military was able to provide. So when we think about external challenges, you know, the lightness of the presence, does that allow us to sort of give the types of packages that some of these host countries might demand in the future? Thank you.
Thanks. Just a couple points. I think I'll also caveat my remarks by saying that I am speaking for myself. This, by the way, is my last week at ICAF. For the last 2 months, I've been dual-hatted as the special representative on avian and pandemic influenza, which is perfect timing on my part. And I'd like to sort of make a few remarks based on my experience from 2004 to 2007, when I was part of that exuberant executive branch out negotiating status of forces agreements to expand our presence, or at least our ability, around the world. I think some of the key points that I would draw from that experience is that if we're going to take the position that we are going to remain globally engaged around the world, that really does require a fair amount of sustained support from our friends, allies, and people where we are expecting to put our forces. It's going to be a very rare occasion that we're going to do a one-shot deal where we will launch an attack or send our forces forward from a country against the wishes of the host government. We might do it once. We'll find it very difficult to do that again. So I think I would echo the point that while it's very important to have these basing agreements, the status of forces agreements, they are necessary but certainly not sufficient, and that it requires a very long-term sustained effort to make sure that the host country is broadly supportive of our aims. I don't think that you can go out and ask a country to be in advance specifically supportive towards a particular military action that the United States might contemplate, but certainly continuing to build that relationship over time is something that is going to be absolutely critical. It's a lot easier to do that with people who are more generally aligned with us. The problem is dealing with countries that are ambivalent both about the United States and about whatever sort of presence that we might have there. And I think this is one of the problems that we're going to face even more and more. If you look at the creation of the Africa Command, for example, I was part of the team that developed that. And the Africans, by and large, with the exception of the Libyans, were supportive of the idea of an Africa Command. And they were supportive of the idea of having elements of that command in Africa. What they were not supportive of, with the exception of Liberia, was putting the headquarters anywhere on the continent. And there were any number of reasons. If you talk to certain countries, they just didn't want the 800-pound gorilla on the continent. If you talk to other countries, they were afraid that if you put the headquarters in one country, every other country would be jealous of that, and it would cause dissension among the AU, which, of course, runs on consensus. And in my view, one of the reasons why I was opposed to putting headquarters there was that it would tie us too directly to the political fortunes of whatever regime was in power in the country to which we decided to put that headquarters. And I think if we're going to look towards the future in these types of countries, the idea of putting together the CSLs or the forward operating sites is a far more useful model for the United States because the infrastructure investment on our part is so much smaller. We are not tied to the fortunes of the government or the regime in office. And if we have greater flexibility, then we're going to have many more options to change. I would also say that if we're looking at places like Manta, where we know that a lease is going to expire or an agreement is going to expire in 4 years, that's the time to start looking around for alternatives. What we've tended to do in the past is wait until a year or so out when realistically we have no options. It's either pull up or pay more. And as we saw with the case of Russia or with the case of China, there are always people who are willing at least to offer, if not pay, more than what we're willing to do. So I think to conclude, I mean, having the agreements in place is one thing. You need to have the overflight clearances are absolutely critical. You need to have the transit rights. I mean, you can put a base somewhere, but if you can't get through the neighboring countries, it's not going to do you a lot of good. And those political arrangements is a very tough balancing act between having a good relationship with the host country, but not being so much in bed with them that you're perceived as supporting an oppressive regime or simply finding yourself held hostage to whatever policies they want to pursue. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much for those thoughtful comments, gentlemen. And we'll take some questions. I guess I'll take the liberty of asking the first one, and then we'll turn it over to the audience. I was noticing a comment made by Secretary Gates a few days ago when he was in Singapore, and he referred to the QDR, and he referred to new thinking in U.S. defense strategy. He made the comment that while the U.S. will continue its commitments to the permanent presence of U.S. forces in the region, and he was referring to Asia at that time, I think, that the U.S. would place ever greater emphasis on building the capacity of partners better to defend themselves. And I'm wondering, in that context, and given that it's the Secretary of Defense speaking there, a shift away from defending territory and more in the direction of building the capacity of partner countries. I'm wondering what any of you or each of you, however you wanted to respond to this, thinks that means for the future of U.S. military presence, permanent presence in Europe and on the Korean Peninsula. Does it continue to make sense to have today's size forces in those two areas? I know there's a great debate about Europe in particular at the moment. If you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I think, you know, as we've seen over time, our force presence in Europe and in Korea has drawn down considerably, and I think that reflects the fact, particularly in Europe, that we don't expect the Warsaw Pact to come thundering through the Fola Gap, and so you need to readjust accordingly. I think the circumstances in Korea are quite a bit more ambiguous as to what North Korea might do. But I think overall the idea of us helping our allies to do more for themselves is absolutely necessary. I mean, we're not at the 1945 situation where the United States had all of the power on the western side. We do have a real problem where I think the United States spends more on defense than the next 10 largest combined, and that's always going to be an issue. Going to be a tricky act between saying we'd like to help you do more and perceptions that we're pulling out. And that's always a very difficult one to imagine. Base protesters notwithstanding, most people get very uncomfortable with the idea that the United States is significantly reducing its troop presence overseas because it signals, rightly or wrongly, that we may be diminishing our treaty commitments.
Let me take a shot at this from, say, up on Capitol Hill. If you consider Congress essentially to be like an allied government, rather than, say, just another branch of the executive or of the U.S. government, Congress seems to have shown a willingness to allow or to accept DOD's thinking, its concepts, its flexibility in terms of overseas basing, to the extent that they feel comfortable that DOD has actually got a plan or is actually being rational and logical in how it goes forward. They seem to be willing to support and accept that. And to the extent that, for example, the Secretary of Defense's remarks indicate that, in fact, we may be developing an actual rational plan for future basing, and it may not look like what we have now. I don't think you're going to get much resistance from the folks on Capitol Hill.
I'm Mitzi Wirth. I'm with the Naval Postgraduate School. Dr. Cooley, I'd like to ask you about what's going to happen in basically the learnings that's going to go on in colleges and universities. It seems to me that what we heard this morning sounded like a very different approach. And how do the academics, in terms of what they're teaching, in terms of international politics and whatever, catch up with these new directions and get away from teaching, you know, grand strategy or those kinds of things? And we have a lot of people who have invested their entire careers in teaching grand strategy. And this just strikes me as a very different game.
That's a great question. I was actually just at Georgetown yesterday talking almost exactly about this issue with a colleague. What's the way forward in our international relations, defense policy classes, and so forth? And without sort of becoming a little bit too theoretical, I think we really need to start opening up, the paradigm sort of, nation states and competing interests. That's fine, but that only takes you so much. And we need to talk a lot more about, I think, global networks, global types of network effects, things like, reputation, how domestic political developments interface with international security challenges, that I think a much richer account of politics and how that feeds into strategy. That, you know, that needs to be part of the conversation. A related point, I know you're not using this paradigm. Much has been said in the academy over sort of the problem of American hegemonic decline. You know, some scholars use the word sort of empire and sort of these kinds of to describe some of these kinds of dilemmas. But I think we don't really study the retrenchment of great powers as much as we study their rise. And this is not saying that the U.S. is necessarily in an irreversible decline and so forth, but I think we need to start thinking more seriously about some, especially in these kinds of economic times, some of the trade-offs that were mentioned here, looking at how some other overseas great powers sort of handled these kinds of choices that they had to make. So I think sort of the question of sort of scaling down, that needs to be one, and then I think creating sort of a more robust political context, that needs to be the other, just top of my head. I think some scholars are looking this increasingly in terms of competitive influence, right? I mean, looking at the kinds of direct links that they make, the interrelationships that they make within countries, right? So, for example, the comment on cooperative security locations, right, that the general said that these foster sort of, you know, business ties that might be lasting and in the end sort of build up support. I mean, I think that's a good example of a direct node-to-node kind of relationship that's very effective. It's the way the Russians operate throughout their sphere of sort of influence, sort of direct links. The terms will be coined differently by different scholars, but I think we need to move away from the billiard ball model for sure.
Thank you. Sure, go ahead. Sure.
This is a rare instance where I get to take off my congressional hat and put on my political scientist hat. I think what you may be, my experience, admittedly from outside the academy, but looking at the academy and following the literature, is that classroom teaching tends to follow the development of theory. Oftentimes it depends on the individual professor you're talking to and what school they may be a part of. And theory tends to follow... It's sort of an inductive reasoning. It tends to follow events on the ground, and now we need a theory to explain it, and eventually we get a theoretical construct, and then that will be reflected in the classroom. And I think over the past 10 or 15 years, you've seen what Professor Cooley was talking about, the older schools of what were called neo-institutionalism, neorealism, realist sort of politics that came out of the Cold War era. And since then, we've seen the rise of new sort of more socially based paradigms that have been referred to as constructivism, for example, social network theory, newer forms of organizational theory that would tend to inject, try to get away from perhaps what you might consider a hard science quantitative basis, trying to move toward a more psychological or social-based social science basis for the grounding in international politics theory. And to the extent that this is only about a decade old anyway, it's going to take a little while for it to be reflected in, say, undergraduate or even graduate classrooms. But I think it's there because there so many new events that don't fit the old realist model have surfaced that you've got to come up with a new theoretical construct to explain them.
Just a quick addition on that. I mean, we've already seen sort of the network concept being deployed more and more to explain transnational threats, actors, the networking of terrorist movements. If you look at, you know, David Kilcullen's new book, sort of talking about the juncture between global networks and locally based sort of resistance movements, and sort of the kind of challenges that sort of brings out.
Thank you, young man in the rear. Give me a microphone.
Oh. Philip Ballard, Booz Allen Hamilton. Mr. Loftus, this might be a best question for you, but I'm wondering if you can comment, given the diminished overseas access we're witnessing and the sensitivity to U.S. footprint overseas, whether the Navy concept of sea basing is a potential solution. It seems to me that it's, you know, it provides minimal footprint, agility, mobility. There's less host nation issues, and it seems like it's a key enabler to the whole of government solutions that the current administration is trying to achieve. Why aren't we talking about Navy sea basing more?
Would you amplify a little bit by what you mean by Navy sea basing? Because if you're only talking about going into littoral states, that works really well. If you're talking about, I mean, my point would be that if you really want to engage around the world, you use the CSLs and the FOSs and others as one tool of engagement. Because even if you remove the irritant of a major footprint, for example, you're still going to have to go through a country. We don't have a huge footprint in Pakistan, for example, but it's absolutely essential that we move through that country to take the fight to Afghanistan. The same thing is true of the Central Asian republics. So by having a base offshore, you don't have that. You don't resolve those issues, and you don't still move away from the requirement to build relationships. I know there's been a lot of talk, for example, about building regional embassies, regional hubs, these sort of things. Personally, I'm adamantly opposed to that idea, because diplomacy is not a flyby operation. You don't do it by email or fax or telephone call. You don't do it by a visit by a high-level official once a month or every 6 months. You have to be there day in and day out to do that and build those relationships. And if you want to have the sustained support, you have to be on the ground. If I can just address this, this is a favorite topic of mine when we talk about CRS and the inability of the State Department to respond to surges. I would point out that the State Department is forward deployed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's our job. So to say that we should be, I mean, I would love to have an additional 10,000 Foreign Service officers that we could send someplace. Congress is never going to fund that. And we have responsibilities to be everywhere. I mean, we talk about not allowing further failed states, not ignoring countries. Well, we're still doing that. I mean, my first post was in Guinea-Bissau, not a place that I would recommend a lot of people go to, but we don't even have an embassy there anymore. And that's, I think, where our failure has been, not our ability to send tons of people to Afghanistan or Iraq, which we've actually been able to do. It's our ability to cover these other areas where we don't have those relationships. And putting ships offshore is not going to fix that.
I mean, I think it also gets to the question of giving ourselves more options, not being locked into any one or dependent on any one relationship that can then be used to sort of, you know, hold us hostage in a negotiation or sort of blackmail us and so forth. And I think, you know, that's, to me, one of the real lessons of Manas that I think has been taken to heart is that, yes, there's diplomatic courtesy in terms of telling a country how important they are, how valued they are, and so forth. That can be taken a little bit too far in that it signals you are absolutely vital. And I've noticed the change in rhetoric over the last couple of months saying, yes, of course, Kyrgyzstan is important, but we have other options. And I think that's the right tone to set, that you do have other options and try to kind of minimize the self-perception some of these countries have, that they're absolutely vital.
I've been meaning to get to the young man in the back on the left there, so could you give him a microphone? He's missed a couple opportunities there.
Thanks. Timothy Walton, Georgetown University. My question is in relation to bases in the Western Pacific. A number of studies have come out last couple of years showing that, to a certain degree, they're pretty vulnerable to ballistic missiles. They have a lot of fuel and munition constraints. Cognizant of the fact that there is, I think, an environment against the expansion of bases in places like Japan, what kinds of solutions should we be looking for to be able to project power in the Western Pacific in a way that's, you know, not politically insensitive, but really strengthens our position there?
Is that directed to anybody in particular?
No.
Anybody?
I'm actually mostly on the political side, but, you know, I've looked at the Korean and Japanese cases, and I was in Seoul for a conference on the move, the relocation in Korea in November. And I think, you know, there's the politics in each of these, I think, in informs the cases quite differently. In Japan, you have a situation where effectively U.S. military presence is outsourced to an island that sort of, you know, is then given lots of goodies, public goods, targeted incentives by the Japanese government to sort of maintain the U.S. military presence there. So I think, you know, the Japanese actually, I think, have very effectively, you know, solved the problem from a political point of view. And the cooperation on the main islands of Japan, whenever there's an incident and so forth, that might sort of open this up into question is actually stellar. In Korea, I think the dilemma is slightly different. It's especially in times like these, it's sort of signaling to sort of the Korean government or trying to reassure them that this deployment southward, right, and expansion of the mission doesn't mean that the U.S. is abandoning its sort of hardline tripwire sort of commitment. And, you know, I think that's probably going to be challenged more and more by the events here. So, you know, I see those two as sort of fundamentally different. You know, the move to Guam, I mean, you know, what implications will that have out of Okinawa eventually? You know, who knows? I think that's still sort of 5 years away.
Let me go back. One of my portfolios in the CRS is defense logistics. So let me get the nuts and bolts and blanket stacking argument in here too. When I was in the Navy, we would transit from Rota, Spain to Norfolk, Virginia. It took us 7 days, a standard steaming time for a carrier. When I was coming back from Westpac, the transit time from Hawaii to San Diego was the same as the transit time from Norfolk to Rota, which means that there was still two-thirds of the Pacific between you and the Philippines because it was 2 weeks to go between Hawaii and the Philippines. And that's not even to Asia yet. So oftentimes I think some people who aren't really familiar with the geographic vastness of the Pacific tend to equate essentially deploying to Europe with deploying to someplace in Asia. And it just is not the case. The Pacific is so huge, and the distance from anything in the continental United States is so vast, and that therefore the deployment times are so much greater that it really is a different strategic animal altogether, in my opinion. And I think we must always remember that. And also, don't forget, we haven't really had the forward basing that we had in Europe with anybody really in Asia. So it is a strategic challenge of, I think, an order of magnitude greater than our relationship going in the other direction.
Sir?
Justin Taff of the Civitas Group. Given the current agreement with the Iraqi government and U.S. policy, what kind, if any, presence do you foresee the U.S. having in and around Iraq around 2012?
Let me just say Congress would like the answer to that one, too.
You look at what – I mean, I would take my guidance from what President Obama has said about that in terms of withdrawing our combat forces from cities by July of this year, combat forces out by 2012. I think there is sufficient flexibility in the agreement where it really does depend on decisions made in Baghdad and in Washington as to what we might want to do. I will say my experience in dealing with the Iraqis, which is no surprise, that there are very many different minds about what a troop presence or a military presence in Iraq may look like, if at all. Certainly on the part of the government, there is a desire to continue to work with the United States, particularly on training missions and whatnot. That may actually look like a military assistance group. If the insurgency continues, it's kind of hard, in my mind, to see a distinction between non-combat and combat troops and how we deal with force protection issues under those contexts. And, of course, given the size of our deployments in Iraq, will have an effect on what our deployments in support areas like Kuwait and elsewhere would be. And I would also venture that whatever the relationship between the Gulf countries and the other Gulf countries in Iran and what kind of relationship they want with the United States as part of that will also play into that, which is a very long-winded way of saying I have no idea.
Well, every case is unique, but some historical perspective would suggest that these agreements will be redone for some time, albeit with different titles and a different guise, perhaps even with a different purpose. When you look at the history of what happened in Japan and Philippines, South Korea, these things tend to be renegotiated. And one of the things that the Iraqis have done is by sort of, putting a three-year time limit on this, they give themselves options in the next round as to what they want to do, what they want to pinpoint, what becomes important to them in 3 years' time may not be something that they do now. So I actually think that this is, the kind of status quo of sort of uncertainty about these sort of classifications, designations, I don't see that being resolved. I mean, I see that as part of the kind of, permanent sort of 3-4 year types of extensions where they will want to give themselves options, not lock themselves into some, 40-year lease or something like that.
Adam Savory representing myself. Three quick questions for all panelists, really. As we look forward to developing and further development of the global defense posture, big question is, what are we posturing for? On top of that, how do we differentiate between sort of the developed networks of bases in Northeast Asia and Europe versus Southern Hemisphere? And finally, in a limited resource environment, where do we focus those resources, especially when they compete versus CONUS investments?
I'll take a first crack at that. I would say that the era of big forward operating bases, such as we've had in Europe for the last 50 years, are over. And in fact, even if you look at what we did in Romania and Bulgaria, which I did the negotiations for, were not the traditional U.S. bases. It was actually access to Romanian and Bulgarian bases, and particularly their training facilities, which, to do the types of activities that we no longer have room to do in Germany and elsewhere. I would be very surprised to see anything looking like a major American military base anywhere in the Southern Hemisphere. I don't think the politics support it. And quite frankly, even if you were to put a headquarters only, the infrastructure in most of these countries is such that by the time you got through building that, it would look remarkably like a traditional American military base with housing and commissaries and schools and whatnot. Again, so you have the impression issue. But what's I think General Cartwright alluded to this, to my mind, what's far more important is to have the flexibility to respond to whatever kind of threats you have. And that means that your ability to go into these countries with their permission and support, and it needs to be more than just permission. It needs to be their active support, particularly on areas like keeping their publics and their neighboring publics on board with our activities. That puts a huge premium on our ability to move forces and their equipment rapidly. I think the idea of pre-positioning is important, but I think it's been more of a theory than it's been an actual practice in terms of most places not putting huge weapon sets, because it does tie us to a particular country, and there are serious security concerns about that, which then, again, do you turn this over to contractors? Do you put military personnel in charge? Do you put foreign military in charge of our supplies? So to my mind, the watchword really is as many of these agreements as you can, building on a large network so that you're able to reposition yourself as required.
Thank you. Anyone else like to pose question? If not, Brett, I think we're finished. Thank you, gentlemen.
I first want to apologize, for not the timing. Some people did not get the message. I think that's a major reason we lost some. We were supposed to start at 10. General Cartwright needed to move it back. And so I apologize to everyone who had to leave early. Also, again, thanks to Rolls-Royce. And remember, on the 16th, we're wrapping it up with General Rignard, who will be here from 10 to 12,
and he's confirmed that time on the 16th. So if you'd like to come, please feel free to let us know. Thanks again for the panel. I thought it was actually a more interesting discussion than I was expecting, which is great. So I thought it was good. Yeah, no, very good. Thank you very much.